You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club, a home for those interested in international trade, shipping, procurement, logistics, and air freight. In fact, all things supply chain in the Americas, Asia, and beyond. This podcast is brought to you by your host, Mike King, and produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a global 3PL that specializes in managing logistics to, from, and within the Asia-Pacific region.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Freight Buyers Club, which, as you've just heard, is produced with the support of Demerco Express Group. I'm Mike King, and please do follow this podcast on your platform of choice, including, of course, YouTube, where you'll also find loads of additional shorter video interviews and news insights. You can also subscribe and listen at www.thefreightbuyersclub.com. Today, we've got an exclusive interview with probably the logistics and shipping world's most powerful rulemaker and enforcer. Although I'm not sure he would like me to call him that exactly. It's Daniel Maffey, chairman of the Federal Maritime Commission. I'll be asking whether the forthcoming presidential elections will impact the FMC's powers, why US legislators are targeting the Shanghai Shipping Exchange, and what US shippers can do to best protect themselves as ocean supply chains snarl up due to this surprisingly strong demand we've seen, and of course, Red Sea diversions. But first, I'm looking at a few of those blockages and the latest supply chain news with Edwin Lopez, who manages a bunch of excellent US-based publications I'm sure you all know, including Supply Chain Dive and Trucking Dive. Edwin, welcome back to the Freight Buyers Club.
Thanks for having me back.
Edwin, we can discuss the rather chaotic world of shipping supply chains in a moment, but we have a new president in town, obviously not in the US, that'll be decided later, not in India either, where Prime Minister Narendra Modi needs a new alliance to form a parliamentary majority, as we're recording here, towards the end of the first week of June. No, I'm talking Mexico. Claudia Sheinbaum will become the country's next president, taking over from her populist predecessor, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. There's a number of firsts here. She's the first female leader of Mexico. She'll also be its first Jewish leader. She's a climate scientist, and she certainly has some big challenges on her desk. Not least crime and security. Edwin, across your dive titles, how are you covering this in terms of the trade implications, or perhaps in terms of what this means for nearshoring? Obviously, Mexico is increasingly important for US importers and also for Chinese companies looking to access the US market, which I know you guys cover in depth.
Yeah, well, Mexico has always been crucial for the US, and that's for several reasons, right? First is its proximity. You can't beat Mexico's location. From a logistics standpoint, it has access to both the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean. It's got a gigantic land border with the United States and very fast access to major markets via air, which is important both for air cargo, but simply also for a businessman in Ohio or a business person in Washington that wants to fly down to visit a supplier. It's very convenient. That's why you're seeing a lot of infrastructure investment in the country, including Sheinbaum's party proposal to build an interoceanic freight railroad that could potentially connect the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean. The second reason is trade relations. Mexico has 14 free trade deals around the world, and as a result, has become an intermediary staging ground for a lot of industries, such as automotive and electronics. But third, and this one is extremely important when it comes to covering the next 6 years under the next administration, Mexico is one of the largest economies in the world. Companies are investing in Mexico not just because of its access to the United States, but also because there's a lot of consumers there too. People forget that. So when it comes to Sheinbaum and thinking about how her presidency may affect supply chains in the next 6 years, we're waiting to see both the new projects she proposes on infrastructure, on labor, on water, et cetera, but also what that says about what her vision for the country's so-called fourth transformation will be. How will she tackle trade, customs, energy, migration, security, and the labor market? We'll start finding out soon.
Yeah, thanks for that, Edwin. When I'm thinking about Mexico, at least its role in terms of this China plus one or nearshoring, I do see these positives. I mean, obviously, Mexico is now overtaking China. It's become the US's largest trade partner, boosted by the North American Free Trade Deal signed by President Donald Trump, known as USMCA. Foreign direct investment into Mexico is obviously up, but there is a negative side to all this. The energy sector is dirty, it's expensive, and many analysts point out that Mexico's tended to underperform despite all these successes in terms of attracting new multinational investments. And maybe more importantly, Chinese companies setting up in Mexico are in the crosshairs of politicians, including Donald Trump, who see a lot of this as pure tariff avoidance. These are all tricky problems to navigate, aren't they?
Yes, very tricky. But I would say Mexico sees it as an opportunity, all of these problems. Listen, Mexico is in the United States court and will ultimately collaborate more than alienate U.S. business interests. I mean, a vast majority of Mexico's exports go to the United States. But you also have to realize that Mexico has so far succeeded by being friendly to businesses around the world. China is no exception to that. U.S. politicians are starting to sound the alarm bells about FDI coming into Mexico from China. But from Mexico's standpoint, dollars from China are just as valuable as dollars from France or Australia. And to be clear, China is not a top 10 source of foreign direct investment in Mexico, at least last year. It grew, yes, but less than 1% of Mexico's FDI came from China in 2023. By contrast, 38% of FDI in Mexico came from the United States.
So it's been over-egged slightly, that relationship in terms of Chinese investment into Mexico. I see your point. Do you think the future trade relationship, which will define the success of a lot of what Mexico sees as an opportunity at the moment, will this all come to a head when the renewal of that USMCA deal in 2026 is due to be agreed?
Absolutely. Everyone I've talked to, that's one of the big topics that we're watching to see is what, if anything, gets revised in the USMCA. Certainly, I suspect U.S. regulators will want to talk about rules of origin and see how they can exclude China a little bit more from that. But it's a tricky subject, as I hinted earlier, because that may or may not be in Mexico's interests. And Mexico has an equal right alongside the U.S. and Canada to advocate for its interests.
Let's have a look at some other tricky issues, I think I'll call them. Those many, many multiple supply chain blockages or disruptions into North America. I'll start with the positive. Water levels on the Panama Canal are finally rising. And that's it. So let's go to the negatives. I'll start with Canada because there's a few things going on there. We've had this threat of strikes at Canadian railways has been hanging over everybody. Canada's customs and immigration agents have also voted to strike. There's talk of people importing early to build up inventory to avoid some of this risk. Also, some shipping services being diverted from Canadian ports to the US. How big an issue is this?
Well, Canada is certainly a flashpoint right now, right? Unless they reach a deal, Canada's border agents are set to strike, which would cause significant slowdowns at the border. This happened for a few days in 2021, so shippers are a little bit more prepared this go around. But also, 2021 was a very different labor environment than 2024. So we're bracing that this one might be a little longer. You never know. On the rail side, we're in a little bit of a holding pattern. The government has intervened to facilitate those negotiations a little. So it will take a few more weeks at minimum before there's real clarity to when there could be a potential strike on Canadian Pacific and Canadian National. But because of both of those things, we've heard shippers are, as you mentioned, already creating their contingency plans, whether that's bringing in goods early or diverting or making sure you have the trucking network in place if the rails do get disrupted. Where it gets complicated is if somehow the border agents are still on strike when the railroads go on strike. That doesn't look likely right now, but you never know with supply chains.
Not another perfect storm, right? We seem to be having an awful lot of those these last few years. Obviously, any issues with congestion in Canada, I mean, it just magnifies the overall tautness of global ocean supply chains at the moment. The foundation of a lot of this is the capacity that's been sucked out by the fleet diversions due to Red Sea conflict. It also appears we're in the midst of either an early peak season or the foothills of what could be a massive Q3 in terms of that import market into North America. On top of all this, or all linked to all this unseasonal demand, we've got already congestion, long vessel delays in Asia at Singapore. at some ports in China. We've also got congestion in the West Med. It links back to the Suez Canal closure as well, up at Barcelona, Tangier. All of this is compounding matters, which means equipment's out of place, ships are out of place, and freight rates are on the rise. And I'll put a number on that for our listeners. On the Asia-US West Coast route, spot freight rates are now surpassing $6,000 per FEU, the highest since August 2022. That's according to S&P. We've got lines rolling, some contracted cargo looking for those spot rates. The latest update from Demerco Express notes two peak season surcharges for the Trans-Pacific eastbound trade during June. So finally, I'll get to you, Edwin. How snarled up can those ocean supply chains get considering all of those issues?
Well, I think everything you mentioned just highlights, right? It's never a dull day in supply chains, is it?
No, it's not.
The ocean market's crazy right now. Yes, high rates, congestion, cargo being rolled over. It sounds really familiar. So when you asked how bad can it get, I think we all lived through the worst supply chain crisis a few years ago. And that's certainly on shippers' minds today. I would guess that everyone's fear is that this could get as bad as 2021. Now, there's one big difference between the pandemic and today, which is that back then, demand was much, much higher. Whereas in the pandemic, if you look across modes, every single mode of transportation was affected. Right now, ocean shipping is sky high, but trucking rates in the US are not. Manufacturing growth is a little stalled right now, according to the latest PMI. These are all signals that it may not get as bad as a pandemic. And in fact, what I'm hearing is people are calling this a little bit more of a very early peak season. So we'll see how long it lasts, but there's no denying the ocean shipping outlook is tough right now.
So just to clarify, so Edwin Lopez is calling an early peak season. Is that what you said? Yeah, not a pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's the outlook that I've heard right now. And when you're looking kind of at the container import growth at US ports as well, it seems the volumes aren't quite at pandemic levels, but we'll see.
We'll see. There's plenty more can happen. Edwin, if you can hang on there, I want to come back to you to discuss this huge clampdown on Chinese e-retailer imports by air. So please stay with me. But now, as trailed, we're turning to a man who I would argue is now the most powerful rulemaker and rule enforcer in global shipping and logistics. He's certainly right up there, not least thanks to the pandemic-inspired expansion of his organization's personnel, budget, and reach. I'm delighted to welcome to the Freight Buyers Club for an exclusive interview the former two-term Democrat congressman and current chairman of the U.S. Federal Maritime Commission. It's Daniel Maffey. How are you, sir?
Well, it's great to be with you, Mike. And of course, I am chairman of a five-person commission. I would say the commission is the powerful entity here. I'm just chairman of it.
Daniel, I know the thoughts and comments expressed here are your own and do not necessarily represent the position of the commission that you chair. But I think maybe let's start with talking a little bit about what the FMC is for our listeners. And please interrupt me if I get anything wrong. So the FMC... it's a federal agency, and its powers and budgets hugely boosted by the Ocean Shipping Reform Act of 2022, which, of course, was a response to the disruptions, delays, and heightened costs U.S. shippers and industry incurred during the pandemic. The FMC is part of the executive branch and therefore part of the Biden administration, but it's non-partisan. You are not up for election later this year. Your term is 5 years, starting in 2022, which is only just confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Is that right so far?
It is right. We are an independent commission, which means that the president does appoint members, but the members serve for terms that do not correspond to the presidential term. The one exception is that I am appointed chairman of the five commissioners by the president. So if another president comes in or the current president picks a new chairman, then I would still be on the commission for my full term, but they would pick a new chairman.
Okay, so you'd remain on the commission. I was going to ask you about, I was going to brave electioneer. I've already been banned once on this podcast for electioneering by YouTube. So I'm like, only for asking about higher tariffs. So I don't know whether I'll make a mess of this now, but I was going to ask you if there is a change of president then. So the FMC's budget would be bulletproof, but you would not be. You'd just revert to being a commissioner. Is that how it would work?
Well, nothing is bulletproof in today's Washington, regardless of who gets elected. However, yes, I might not be the chairman, but the difference between my agency and some of the other kinds of things is that I work so closely with both the Democrats on this commission and the Republicans work so closely together that if presidency were to shift, a Republican was to come in as chair, we've already worked in so much that, yeah, would a couple things change? Possible. But for the most part, we do everything as a team anyway, and most things by consensus or near consensus. So you wouldn't get the same kind of changes as you would in the rest of government.
It's the second anniversary of the Ocean Shipping Reform Act on June the 16th. I want to get into some of the new rulings and what we have coming down the pipeline a bit later on. But I've got a little softball for you, if you want to put it that way, in US sports. What's your take, Daniel, on how the FMC has performed in terms of how you've met the mandates of OSRA in a way that has benefited or made things fairer for U.S. shippers or international trade more generally?
I think the key thing about our OSRA implementation has, for me, been to really try to follow the guidance of Congress. Maybe this is partly because I'm a former congressman, but it also might be because of the way the Ocean Shipping Reform Act came about, the incredible grassroots support, the incredible bipartisan support that then, President Biden was able to sign a law that, you know, was put into effect without the kind of back and forth that you see so often in Washington. This was really a textbook case. And so because of that, we really tried to follow both the letter and the spirit of what has been in OSRA. I think we've done a very, very good job. There are a few things that took a little longer than maybe I had hoped. But that said, though, the deadlines were very, very ambitious in the first place. We've now got the detention and demurrage billing rule fully in effect. That I really think is very, very important because following OSRA's guidance, it really is changing the paradigm of how detention and demurrage is determined and billed and who gets the bills, and really trying to bring it back to its original purpose, which was to keep cargo moving. And I think that would be incredibly important. We do have another rule that is very soon to come out in final form, the so-called refusal to deal, but it also protects exporters from carriers unreasonably refusing to load their cargo. That should be out by July 4th at the latest. And, we've got so many other things, including beefing up our enforcement, beefing up our consumer protections, using those new resources that Congress has given us to do those things. So we've really done a lot, and I don't want to list them all on your podcast, but our website details it pretty well at fmc.gov.
I do want to come back to some of those key points. I just want to look at the shipping market. We discussed this before we came on, because there are parallels, some people are saying, to what happened in the pandemic that inspired OSRA in the first place. The global shipping fleet is stretched due to Red Sea diversions. We've got spot markets almost hitting those sorts of COVID levels. Contracted cargoes being rolled. We've got box shortages. Front haul rate outmatching back haul rate. Do we know what happened during the pandemic for agricultural exporters out of the US? If we use a football analogy, is this the second half?
Or maybe the fifth inning. I would say that it's more akin to overtime or extra innings, because it's not a continuation of the exact same kind of demand that occurred during COVID, which was caused by all of us staying at home, trying to educate our children, trying to figure out what to do with our home offices, all of our leisure occurring at home. That is no longer the case. So that part has changed. But what hasn't changed is, and in fact, what I think you're actually intensifying, is just the level of unpredictability in the entire system. You are fond of quoting British prime ministers, so I have to quote, of course, the famous Harold Macmillan quote when he was asked, what he's the most determines the government's course. And he says, events, dear boy, events. We're always going to have these events. They're not predictable. Whether we're talking about what's going on, blocking the Suez Canal to free ocean shipping, the Panama Canal, very different set of events, but also a limit. Any of the kinds of things that you've been talking about on this podcast and over the last several months, these are going to continue to occur. And I don't think anyone can really predict where they're going to go next. And in fact, I think one of the things you sort of see is once the industry kind of comes to a consensus that, okay, indeed, shipping rates are going to go down over the next few months, are going to go up over the next few months, you can bet it'll go the opposite way.
Well, there's definitely a lot of moving parts at the moment. Within all of this, Daniel, do you see the FMC as as maybe a ref or a referee or as an enforcer, a bit of both? How would you describe it?
I do. And I, you know, I've said this before. I think the big difference that the Ocean Shipping Reform Act made, I mean, ocean shipping was a deregulated industry in the United States, has been since 1984. And frankly, I know I may be a Democrat, but that I acknowledge that deregulation has really worked for American shippers. It lowered shipping costs. The competition has done a lot. And although I do think there is a role for government when necessary, the best solutions are usually come from the industry, and government should step in to enforce them. But things were getting a little out of hand. There were abuses, et cetera. And it was clear that the FMC may be setting the rules, but wasn't really a participant on the field. Well, what I think happened with OSRA is we are now a participant on the field, but we're not a participant as a player. No, it's still a deregulated industry, but we are a referee calling the fouls in real time, giving out the yellow cards, the red cards if necessary in real time. And that is, I think, what is the big difference between regulation now and regulation, you know, when I first came to the commission in 2016.
Okay. You mentioned detention and demurrage and some of the progress you've been making there. I'll just unpack that slightly for our listeners who mightn't be following that quite so much. In February, a final rule on demurrage and detention billing practices was published following a unanimous vote of the five commissioners. The rule establishes requirements for how common carriers and marine terminal operators must bill for demurrage and detention charges and provides clarity on who can be billed within that time frame. It also specifies the process for disputing bills. This took effect on May the 28th. So how does this change things for shippers? Is there anything they should be doing differently in light of all of this disruption we have at the moment in terms of what they do on contracts with carriers or forwarders or railroads or in terms of checking their invoices?
Yeah, I mean, we may want to get back to the contracting issue, but not necessarily because of the D&D rule per se, but just because of the way the industry is changing. But in terms of the detention demurrage rule per se, it does a lot in terms of guaranteeing to a shipper that when they're billed, there's got to be enough information to really understand what that bill was all about. And it has to be done within 30 days. And the company, the ocean carrier or the NVOCC has to give 30 days to the shipper in order to dispute the bill. So I do think and it doesn't, by the way, mean that a bill can't be disputed beyond that, but that there has to be that 30 days given. To me, what that means for ocean shippers is in order to get full advantage of this, they really should review their bills carefully. The whole point of it is to connect what's going on in the supply chain, whether boxes are being moved with the goods to their final destinations and unloaded, and then whether that box is returned, to connect that to the charges. The challenge that happened during COVID was either whether it was reality or perception or became both, that connection was lost. And therefore, American shippers, importers, and exporters felt that they were going to have to pay these huge charges no matter what they did. And so they stopped doing it. Truckers sometimes were locked out, even if because of a disputed bill on one of their customers, they couldn't pick up for any of their customers. This all added to congestion, the opposite of what the system was supposed to do. So by setting up these rules, it makes it more clear. Every now and then you do hear a hypothetical about, well, wait a minute, hold on. What if we don't get back to you in 30 days? And what if our trucker didn't pick it up or did pick it up and then we got the bill and the bill, you know, and then we paid the bill and sent it to the trucker and the trucker said, well, I picked it up. So there is one piece of advice. None of that, by the way, you'd still have the right to dispute it if you paid a bill and it was wrongly billed, even if it was after 30 days. But forgetting that, you should keep an eye on your supply chain. Shippers should understand and should know if they send a trucker to get something within 30 days, maybe not instantaneously, but within 30 days should know if that shipment actually got there. And if you don't want to do that, there's plenty of 3PLs that will take care of the whole process for you. But if you want to be the shipper of record, you should keep track of your supply chain enough to know what your trucker is doing. I would think most of the listeners to your program already do that and do it very, very well. But maybe that's the key thing, is that if you don't have a good sense of what's getting charged, detention, demurrage, and why, now that this rule is in place, you know, the carriers have to tell you. They have to give you that much information. And so I guess it would just behoove shippers to make sure they're paying attention. And if they are paying attention, I don't think they'll have any problem challenging the bills that they know are, you know, that didn't really happen. And most of the time, by the way, they will have success. The carriers will say, will acknowledge it. Everybody makes mistakes. This isn't about playing gotcha. This is about getting the system right so that we keep cargo and equipment moving.
Okay, I'll come back to that challenging process in a moment and who has access to it. But the incentive principle, so this is the idea that a detention and demurrage charge has got to be reasonable. It must help promote the efficient movement of cargo and or equipment and not be for some other purpose. Now, in light of what happened during the pandemic and what might be brewing right now, that some other purpose, there's been accusations thrown around in the past that, oh, that other purpose could be making money. Are you happy that the powers that you have now satisfy the incentive principle and protect US shippers?
Look, I don't think anything is perfect. I certainly don't think any rule or regulation is perfect. So we're going to have to keep on, you know, once we experience this a while, once we've seen some cases, you know, we'll have to take a look at it. And there may have to be additional rules. We may have to make adjustments. But that's true for anything in government, at least if government is open-minded and responsive to the people it's supposed to be serving. I will say this. First of all, the incentive principle is articulated so simply, and you did a very good job just then. But it's easy to sort of say now, but it was first articulated by Commissioner Rebecca Dyer, our most experienced commissioner. I think when we look back at supply chain history in 50 years, this is going to be a major thing that students cite. I think it is really that important. And Rebecca's work on that, she's still my senior Republican colleague, is very, very important in sort of leading to that. Look, it's not that we don't want the carriers to make money. We want them to make money, but we want them to make money in an honest and transparent way on the rates. The rates, what the market is, et cetera. The problem with where detention demurrage went is that what they were saying was for a detention or demurrage reason was often perceived, and perhaps perceived correctly, to really be just a stealth way of increasing the bottom line and not really to move cargo. And this corrects that. So look, if the demand is there and the carriers say, well, we need to up the rates because of supply and demand, they can still do that. There's nothing that we're going to do to touch that particular market. All we're doing is saying, if you're representing a charge as you didn't pick up your full box or you didn't return your box on time, then that has to be honest.
Yeah, separating the rates from surcharges and other fees is quite difficult when you look at some of those bills, but I'm sure you know more about that than me.
Well, I'm learning more. I mean, I think it is just the beginning. By the way, of course, as we know, as anyone knows who has cable television or mobile phone service or gets on an airplane, there's all sorts of, this is not the only industry, in which case there's all sorts of fees and stuff that, you know, it's part of modern life. But I think to the extent the market works better, the more transparent it is. When I get on hotels.com and I look by hotel price and I say, oh, here's one that's, you know, $250 a night. I stay in important cities, I guess. Here's one that's $250 a night and here's one that's $350 a night. Well, I'd rather go on the $250. I click it and I see that there's a $150 resort charge. Well, that's not being very honest, is it? So what we need to, in generally, I would like things to become more honest, but we'll start with detention and demurrage charges, because if they're not honest, then when something comes along like COVID and that kind of demand boom, the entire system gets clogged.
I'm just wondering where you're up to in terms of getting rid of that backlog of claims from during the pandemic. My colleague at the Lodestar, Alex Whiteman, he tracked down 38 claims worth around $67 million against various carriers and forwarders. These included a few big ones, the now bankrupt Bed Bath & Beyond after $31 million against Evergreen, MSC, Yang Ming. There was Gitti and Peloton are after certain, quite a lot of millions from Flexport. Is there a lot of claims still out there that date back to that period?
Yeah, I would say quantity-wise, we've taken care of a great many of them. There are certainly a number of outstanding ones that are pretty newsworthy, and you just mentioned a bunch of them that will take some time to litigate. And of course, I can't speak to any particular case. But I think we made great progress. And when I say we, though, I really should say the whole industry as a whole. I mean, I know that the carriers sometimes get tired of criticizing me, and I may criticize them later on this podcast, but a good portion of them have done a lot of work in trying to adjudicate these claims, come to settlements, et cetera. So I guess I would say I'm happy with the progress we've made there. But, you know, certain kinds of disputes will take a long time to play out, and we want to make sure that due justice is served. So some of those cases continue. And a lot of them, by the way, are elongated by agreements between both parties. When they come before an administrative law judge at the commission, they set a deadline, et cetera. When that deadline is broken, we have to approve the extension, but we generally only approve the extension if all parties are in agreement on that.
We'll just take a short break. We'll be back with you in a second.
This podcast is proudly produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a trusted provider of global shipping and contract logistics services in Asia, Europe, and North America. Demerco's particular strength is in Asia, where it gives shippers the freight capacity and local market expertise to streamline freight movements to and from the region, particularly for trans-Pacific lanes. With 130 forwarding and logistics locations across China, India, and Southeast Asia, Demerco connects Asia with the world like no other global 3PL. You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club.
Just listening to some of those names that I threw out there. We had Peloton, Flexport, the big carriers. Are you happy that SME shippers have got access to all of the dispute mechanisms that you're making available? Because quite often there's a big imbalance between a small shipper versus a large forwarder or a carrier or a railroad. Are you doing anything to help make that, maybe provide legal assistance or resource, financial resources, so that all people, all every man, every forwarder, every shipper can access the FMC's dispute mechanisms?
That's certainly an ideal that I would like to achieve. But the law, it doesn't give a special boost or anything. But what it does do is it allows the FMC itself to bring cases. We have a very potent enforcement division with much more teeth than it used to have because of the added resources in OSRA and a reorganization that we did a couple of years ago. So part of that is that, yes, if you're a big company, a big shipper, you can bring your own private case and have your own lawyers argue it. But if you're not, the FMC can still bring a case, and you still have many, many different avenues. The other thing that, of course, we do have is a consumer affairs division that can advise you, and you don't necessarily, have to file a case. You can come to them and just ask, but what are my options? And those are all very important things. Again, fmc.gov will get you to a platform where you can sort of access where all of those various services are. So yes, I certainly think that it's very important that there be fairness across the board, particularly because the larger you are, in some cases, that does give you more market power. And in a free market system, which ocean shipping is since deregulation in 84, it is going to have certain advantages. But we do try at the FMC anyway, when it comes to dispute resolution, to make it as fair as possible to every player, particularly, look, I was a congressman from a very middle class, working class farm, cities, but farms as well, district. And it's still in my blood is trying to protect the family business and the relatively small agricultural exporter.
Oh, yeah. Well, as we're on exporters, yeah, you mentioned this earlier. I think you said July the 4th is what we're talking about here.
Hopefully before then, but July the 4th seems to be the day that everybody wants to pick these days. So I thought I would pick it through.
Well, we're getting rid of the Tories here, I hope. Anyway, it's about time.
Yeah. Don't get yourself in trouble again.
Another ban. Okay. Yeah, well, US exporters, though. So we had this big problem in the pandemic. They couldn't get boxes, mainly because the carriers wanted to get the boxes back to Asia so they could reload them and get those massive rates on the front haul. Now, one element of OSRA was a mandate designed to protect them against this happening again. So it's very timely. This is the unreasonable refusal to deal with respect to vessel space accommodations. Now, did you say July the 4th, the latest step for this?
So I mean, July the 4th is sort of my own deadline. I actually hope it'll come out before then, but the publishing of the final rule, and then there's going to be a bit of a period before the final rule takes full effect. So I would expect that to be by the end of summer. But there's not going to be any surprises about what's in this. We did a supplemental rulemaking, and obviously you've made a few adjustments, but much of it is going to be similar to that. So, and really it does two things. It's not just for exporters, by the way. One of the things, an unreasonable refusal to deal, importers can take advantage of that too. An ocean carrier has to be willing to negotiate with you. They can't just turn you down for a particular reason and just sort of say, well, I just don't want to deal with you for whatever random thing of the kind of industry you're in or what have you. It has to be a reasonable thing. I mean, I won't give examples, but I think we can all imagine reasons why it wouldn't be unreasonable to deal with to not deal with somebody who has been dishonest. But for the most part, this means that ocean carriers have to negotiate, have to say, okay, well, here's the cost for space. And if you're willing to pay that cost, then that is what it's going to be. And if you have more boxes that you can guarantee, that cost will go down, et cetera. But it has to be a reasonable negotiation. The part that affects just exporters is space on the ship. So what you were sort of saying during COVID, there were many instances where importers, exporters rather, particularly agriculture exporters, felt that their boxes were left behind because, as you mentioned, it was the imbalance between how much money was being made by importing was so great that even the opportunity cost of the box, of just not wanting to let that box be used for an export and, you know, get diverted in Asia for even a couple of weeks, became an issue. But I think that the Congress sort of said, well, look, that's a little unreasonable. If you're going to take advantage of the ability to import into the United States, when that's particularly lucrative, you do have to offer an export service. And so that's really what that is to do. I would say most of the major carriers, they have strong export services. I think a lot of them, by the way, have strengthened their export services and contacts and the ability of exporters to get space, in part anticipating, being the law and anticipating this. What this really, though, is that there were some carriers, for instance, who just popped up just to take advantage of the imports, right? You know, came in, dumped a lot of imports in LA or Long Beach, turned around with empty boxes and went back to get more and refused to offer any export service at all. That would no longer be allowed. You'd have to give some sort of reasonable reason why that was the case. Now, you know, that can include a number of things, weather and shipworthiness, et cetera. We're not saying that you have one export box for every import box, by no means. But we are saying that the carriers have to be reasonable and can't just take advantage of this huge import surge. And, you know, like I said, there's some more details to be ironed out, but I strongly suspect that we'll have that final rule published by the 4th of July.
Thanks for that, Daniel. Okay, the Ocean Shipping Reform Implementation Act of 2023 passed the chamber in March. In theory, this could beef up OSRA. Now, I know this is still before Congress and there's no progress likely in the immediate months. But when this came out, it was quite a big story in the media because it was reported by many as targeting China's Shanghai Shipping Exchange, which publishes the Shanghai Containerized Freight Index. The idea being that the SSE provides China or Chinese companies with an advantage that might allow those companies or that country to manipulate container freight markets to the disadvantage of US businesses and consumers. What's the thinking behind that? Or do you agree with that portrayal of that act in terms of what it might be used for?
I mean, I have to admit, because having been in Congress and knowing the way things could change, often now as a regulator, I'm so focused on the law as it currently is, particularly given that we still have parts of OSRA 22 to implement, that I'm not familiar enough with all the details of it. Everything you're saying makes sense to me as at least part of what was proposed, but it did just pass the House. You know, I do have to remind some of my UK friends that unlike the UK, here the Senate actually probably, if anything, is more powerful than the House as opposed to the House of Lords and the House of Commons here in your country. So, you know, I don't necessarily see that in an election year going very far. It's possible aspects of it will. We do have, because of OSRA 22, already a rule in the works to look at the shipping exchanges. It certainly doesn't go as far as that new proposal, but I do think we do need to make sure that there's honesty there and we know what we're getting from shipping exchanges, and particularly the way that they're in operation and what kinds of services they offer. So I don't see any major changes coming this year, perhaps next year, but if parts of that get through, then of course we'll implement them to the best of our ability.
Watch out, Shanghai Shipping Exchange, I guess.
Well, I think that is a subset of issues that you covered before about China and a growing distrust among both parties in a country where at least the politicians of both parties don't seem to agree on much. They both agree that China has in some ways treated American consumers and shippers somewhat unfairly. And so they're looking at several different things and several different dangers. And that's really their business. We're here to help wherever we can. And certainly in areas where we already regulate Chinese entities, such as we do have special powers when it comes to controlled carriers, such as Costco or OOCL. And we keep a close eye on them. And for the moment, you know, those companies are cooperating with us. But we will continue to ask questions where we feel it's important to.
It's not just China that's been in the crosshairs, so to speak. I seem to see this more often online than I certainly used to. And this is the role that foreign ocean carriers play in terms of US trade and whether that's a good and sensible thing for US industry and the US economy. when we last spoke, there was talk of an ocean shipping antitrust enforcement act, which would repeal the exemption for foreign ocean carriers from all US federal antitrust laws. I couldn't find this anywhere, if I'm absolutely honest. Did that legislation make any progress at all?
No.
No, right. Okay, that'll be why then.
Part of it is a very inside Washington way that legislative proposals are dealt with in terms of the committees that they go to, and the Judiciary Committee being very different than the Transportation Committee. So when you start getting into antitrust measures, partly because of some differences amongst the parties, but also I think that while during COVID it was easy to sort of say, well, we should repeal any kind of antitrust protection that ocean carriers have, when people looked at it more closely, some of the, if you were to say, discourage the alliances by changing the rules, you would find that the alliances have a lot of pro-competitive impacts. And what I mean by that is, because of the nature of ocean shipping and container ship size, and you could have a medium-sized port in the United States, even a fairly large port, such as an Oakland or Baltimore or South Carolina, offer more services if there are alliances than if there are not alliances. And those services do compete on price in all three of the major carrier alliances that currently exist. And so because of that, I think they took a look at it and said, well, it may not be the time to make major changes. I still advocate some additional teeth in it for the FMC. I think that we should be allowed on our own to stop an alliance if we feel that it's violating the current Shipping Act standard. Right now, we have to go to a federal court and do it. But that's a fairly minor thing. And like I said, I was very happy with the Ocean Shipping Reform Act, even though if it didn't have everything in it that I was advocating, it certainly did change the overall paradigm and gave us a lot more strength, I think, to do what Congress and the American people wanted us to do.
Just that the overall election climate, I mean, in general, I would say protectionism is on the rise around the world, but the US particularly, we're seeing this, and it's not just about China, although it's very heavily focused on China. At the moment, we've got this clampdown at US Customs and Border Protection on Chinese retailers using the de minimis process to their advantage. There's a lot of this rhetoric about trade competition. Do you think foreign container lines should be concerned that there's more coming along the lines of what we've just discussed there? Do you think this will get heightened as we get closer to November?
Right. So a sort of two answers to that question on the sort of more micro level. First of all, it's not my area, but I do think that any effort to clarify the rules and make sure they're enforced, such as that by CBP, I have to, you know, say something positive about those kind of efforts, because the whole point of rules is that people have to follow them. And if people are allowed to get around them for some reason, another oft mentioned way is to ostensibly use Mexico as a way to hide that the goods are really coming from China or whatever. And there's rules of origin and other kinds of rules, but you have to enforce those rules. So that, I think, is not protectionism, or at least not additional protectionism. It's just following the rules that have already been negotiated. In terms of overall, tariffs and that sort of thing, I clearly think they're affecting the so-called early peak season now. It's one of those factors, particularly because it may make a good soundbite to talk about huge tariffs. It doesn't necessarily make a good soundbite to say, and there's going to be a healthy transition period to make sure that there's no major economic problems that are caused by that. Our commission is agnostic. We will enforce the rules, whatever they are, that follow us. We will try to help shippers, whatever that case. So it's not our job to get involved with that. But I would say that as one category of unpredictable events, to go back to McMillan, they shouldn't be worried about it. There's all sorts of things they should be worried about. And I really do think, Mike, that if I may say, that the paradigm has shifted here. I think people have to stop trying to predict the next set of events and figure out a way around them, and more figure out a way to make their entire supply chains basically diversified to an extent that they're fairly bulletproof. Like, there's two kinds of ways that we can follow our retirement investments, right? We can look at the stock market every day and get panicky about this stock going down or that stock going down, or, oh, my whole portfolio is gone, or I should readjust this and readjust that and constantly manipulate it. Or we can pick a long-term strategy, invest our money in mutual funds and other kind of areas which we know are going to be balanced for risk, and wait. And over the long run, I'm quite confident that these trends will work themselves out. all sorts of kind of risks. It's over the short run is the problem, but that's not how we do things today in logistics. In logistics, you know, we try to predict what's going to happen over the next quarter or over the next 6 months and try to outsmart it. And I don't think anybody can do that, right? I mean, you love Winston Churchill, and even he said that it's much easier to predict the future after it's already happened, right? So something along those lines, I can find the exact. I do think it is evolving now, but it is going to continue to evolve to a point where the real smart folks in logistics, instead of always going for the absolute cheapest way to do something, are going to start figuring out ways to do things where over the long run, they're guaranteed that they will have a decent supply chain, et cetera. And it may be more expensive over the short run because, yes, maybe you will warehouse a few more parts. Maybe you will utilize some somewhat less efficient shipping routes through Europe or through Asia, then, you know, and you'll diversify a number of different countries. But in the long run, it'll lead to a much more stable business. And so I do think that you're going to start seeing more and more of that, because whether we're talking about government intervention, whether we're talking about climate, whether we're talking about, you sometimes talk about labor, you know, all over the world, whether we're talking about different kinds of geopolitical events and the fact that we're now in a different kind of post-globalized world, you're going to keep seeing these things. And again, trying to predict the next so-called black swan event, they're not black swans anymore. They're gray pigeons. And we're just going to have to acknowledge that they're going to keep showing up, and you can't predict them. But there are ways, there are strategies to deal with events that are not predictable over the short run when trends can be predicted over the long run.
So embrace short-term chaos through long-term diversification, right?
I mean, it's easy for me to say, right, sitting in a government office, but I do think that that is sort of the future, is it, at least for those folks who really want to integrate their supply chains into their business models. We have to give up this idea that ocean transportation is always going to be a nominal cost and acknowledge that it's not about just ocean transportation, it's about the entire transportation package, and that there is going to be a cost to it. But if you diversify correctly, if you have the right strategies, long-term success strategies, you'll be fine over the long term. If you try to take a gamble, you know, that, okay, well, I'm going to predict that nothing major is going to happen to my supply chain, and so I'm going to not have any parts, that is when you're going to lose, and particularly lose when an opportunity presents itself to sell a lot of product because of the demand, but you didn't do a good job of making sure that your supply chain could withstand extraordinarily higher shipping costs because of that same consumer demand. And I think that is the kind of lesson from COVID. In that sense, COVID is not over, right? The particulars of COVID are over, but the world, the new abnormal, as MIT's Yossi Shepherd says, that is what we're in. It's a different kind of world.
Just briefly before we finish, Daniel, is there anything else in the pipeline that might help US shippers that we haven't already discussed? Or maybe they have all the protection they need now?
Oh, gosh, yes. Again, I think I would stay tuned. We at the FMC, I guess I would say that, you know, if I'm no longer a congressman, so I don't have constituents in the same way as I did when I represented an area of central New York State, but I do have constituents in that they're American importers and exporters. And I think, you know, I'm constantly looking for ways to help provide guidance, particularly to make things more accessible and more understandable. And so we'll definitely be looking for more opportunities to do those things, whether it's in the context of OSRA implementation or a different kind of context. We'll be trying to do that. We're trying to continue our watchdog efforts on things like fees or because of something like the Suez Canal issues, to make sure that those are fairly noticed and do what the carriers say they will do. Again, we're not trying to play a game of gotcha with the carriers or with terminal operators or other regulated entities, but we are trying to kind of be an advocate out there for more transparency, make sure people know what they're getting.
Okay, thank you. Please all stay with me while I discuss through some of the shipping implications and key takeaways from this conversation with Industry Dive's Edwin Lopez. But for now, Daniel Maffey, Chairman of Federal Maritime Commission, thanks for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
As always, Mike, thank you.
Edwin, what were your main takeaways from Daniel there in terms of where all of this leaves shippers as we move into what could be quite a tumultuous third quarter?
Well, Mike, it really sounds like the agency has taken AUSER 2022 as a mandate to try and systemically address some of the biggest pain points that arose during the pandemic. The big one, of course, is the tension in the merge, which Maffei mentioned is often seen as sort of a junk fee in shipping. So we'll see what happens with the new rules. But I was also intrigued listening to how he talked about the reasons behind the unreasonable refusal to deal rule, where he talked about how a lot of small new shipping companies came into the market to take advantage of the pandemic boom, often at shippers' expense. That's something that I heard a lot during my reporting during the pandemic, but few people are talking about today. So it's great to see that the FMC is looking ahead and putting rules in place today to make sure that in the next big crisis, it doesn't get out of hand again.
And that also made a lot of sense, didn't it? I understand if you're, in terms of the US economy, you need to have those boxes available for exports, and you don't want people coming in for a short period of time, taking all those meaty profits and then not sticking around to provide the service that they're supposed to on that backhaul. It'll be interesting to see how those exports, when those backhauls are needed later in the year, whether those boxes will be available. I did ask around about whether US shippers and industry now feel like they have better protection from FSE than they did pre-OSRA 2022. Bit of a mixed picture. Do you think there's more the FMC should be doing?
I'll start by saying I don't envy the Federal Maritime Commission. They have a huge mandate to help keep ocean shipping in check, and prior to OSRA, a lot fewer resources to do it with. So with that in mind, I think even Maffei would say yes. I mean, one thing you and he talked about is how many resources it takes to put together a claim. And while the FMC has tried to make the process for making claims and appeals more accessible, I'd wager a lot of smaller shippers don't even know where to begin yet or how to begin in making those arguments. But beyond that, I also know there's a big wish list in the industry for improvements that the FMC and others can tackle. In 2021, and I'll never forget this, talking back about the pandemic as we just were, the Agriculture Transportation Coalition put together a list of 64 ideas for rules, processes, and regulations that could help resolve the congestion. Some of those, I should say, were already being tackled by the FMC, like exploring how data sharing works in the supply chain. Others have been incorporated into OSRA and are now seeing action like DND and unreasonable refusal to rule. Regardless, I think what we learned in the pandemic is that there's a lot to be done if we want to make our US supply chain work better. So yes, there's a lot more the FMC will have to do.
Well, I hope Daniel will come back on and give us an update on his progress. And maybe he could comment also on the differences in pronunciations that we have on. In the US West Coast, we've got Maffei. On the UK's West Coast, Maffei. So Daniel, maybe you can come on and say which pronunciation you prefer on the next time around. Okay, Edwin, finally, air cargo. The biggest feature of the global air cargo market this year has been the massive increase in volumes attributed to Chinese retailers such as Temu and Shein, who really have been moving the market. A lot of that extra demand has actually been into the US market, US imports, fast fashion. US Customs and Border Protection has cracked right down on this in a bid to ensure that all small packages, especially those from mainland China, are legal. That is, it's not drugs, all the narcotics, counterfeit goods, and also to make sure the de minimis process isn't being abused. We're hearing of warehouses getting full, air freight markets are certainly getting nervous. Customs brokers are being suspended. What's the latest?
I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's an issue that ironically touches on pretty much everything else we've talked about, right? I think, and first and foremost, I want to give credit. The Lodestar has done great reporting on this topic. So I want to give some credit there. I'll say there's still a lot of unanswered questions that we're looking at. These questions include, who is a problem when it comes to de minimis and imports from China? How big of a problem is it? We're looking to see how big it is, what changes might happen on the freighter market, right? To see if we start seeing a big decrease in freighter shipments to the US, we can start to see how big of a problem this truly is. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, how long will the crackdown last? The reason I hone in on those three questions is kind of bringing you back just a personal story here, Mike. I grew up on the US border, right? And I lived and crossed the border every single day and saw how when Customs and Border Protection cracks down, sometimes they crack down for a day, sometimes they crack down for a month, sometimes they crack down for an hour. And that's a big question when it comes to supply chains, right? Is this crackdown a point in time approach, something that they're going to try and do to send a signal to customs brokers, send a signal to importers that CBP is paying attention? Or is this something that's permanent now and that will continue to be the new reality for the next few years, if not few months?
Or maybe this is just one battlefield in this US-China trade war. Is that another possibility as we head into the elections? Trades are playing a big part in both candidates' canvassing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think what we've seen from the Biden administration and the Trump administration beforehand is this whole of government approach to tackling trade with China, where it's not just these new tariffs that have been levied against electric vehicles. It's not just de minimis shipments and e-commerce with China. It's all of it, right? And it's truly every single, or even the Federal Maritime Commission and what they could do about regulating ocean shipping.
A note to self, do not hashtag election tariffs or I'll get yet another ban on YouTube. Edwin Lopez, managing editor at the Dive Publications. Thanks for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
Thanks so much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Freight Buyers Club, produced in partnership with the Demerco Express Group. Please subscribe and follow on your platform of choice or sign up for delivery to your inbox at thefreightbuyersclub.com. This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the fantastic editing of Karen Ball and Tom Matthews. And finally, thank you all for listening. The next episode will be with you soon.